From the campus of Stanford University, this is Schools In.
They believe that what we're being told is everything they need to know, and they just pay attention to that.
You actually have to teach the teachers how to teach for innovation.
With your hosts, Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
Welcome to Schools In. I'm Denise Pope, senior lecturer with the Graduate School of Education here at Stanford, and I am with my co-host, Dan Schwartz, dean of the Graduate School of Education.
Hello, Dr. Back-to-School Pope.
Hello, Dan.
Yeah, yes. So it's about that time of year. People are going back to school. Schools are starting. Challenge Success is going to have like a huge shindig to kick off.
We are.
Yeah.
We've got a lot of stuff coming up.
So we thought we'd go sort of to the top about going back to school. We talk about superintendents.
Sounds good.
Right. And so as a little warm-up, what do you think superintendents worry or dream about the most?
So what do they worry about?
They have a big job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What I would say, school safety, right? Like,
That's what they dream about the most.
No, worry. You said worry.
Or dream.
Okay. Well, then I have two different answers. I would say worry, school safety. And I would say dream that every kid has an amazing, fulfilling experience.
Those seem good.
Yeah?
Yeah, yeah. I like that. They probably have two cell phones, one for worries and one for dreams.
Yeah, exactly.
Elliot Eisner was a very august professor.
He was my advisor.
Yes. He was a professor of art, education, but also psychology, everything. He's a brilliant guy. And so he would have this meeting with superintendents because he said they had the loneliest job in the world. And they would come in and do a lunch once a month. You know, there'd be like eight or nine. So one time he brought me in to meet with them, you know, as a curiosity. You know,
look at this guy. Yeah.
And I explained to him, you know, that I study like the science of learning. And I said, if there's one thing I could do for you, you know, that I could help, what would it be, you know, where I could use the science of learning? So I thought all of them would say, help us raise the test scores. Mm. And that was not the case. In every single case, it was about making the kids more adaptable when they left school so they could adapt and be innovative and adjust to life beyond school.
Interesting.
Yeah, so I thought that was interesting, you know, as opposed to kind of the grind it through, do well on the test kinds of stuff. They really were thinking about bringing these children into the world, not just their immediate experience and success within school. So I that was very heartening to me. I've used that fact in about 18 papers I've written.
Really?
Yeah, I really like it. I think it's a testament to how caring people are in education.
I mean, okay, I totally agree, but this is a bad thing to say, but do you think it's because you had the population in and around Silicon Valley in that room? I'm like the optimist on this show. Right. You're usually the pessimist, pushing back a little bit Dan.
It could be. If it had been that, they would have said things like, I want them to develop entrepreneurial skills.
Adaptability was more...
I think it was more their ability to go out in the world and continue learning as they need to and flex to the situations that, you know, it doesn't end in school. It doesn't end with a test.
I think that's incredibly important in today's world.
But it could be. It could be that they were sort of like, you've got to make them innovators. They've got to make the next app.
We're all from Silicon Valley. Yeah, yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Well, I'm excited to have our guest here, who is a superintendent of schools. Eric Burmeister is superintendent of schools in Menlo Park, California. His district serves about 3,000 students in pre-kindergarten through eighth grade. It includes three elementary schools and a middle school, and they added the Early Learning Center for ages 3 to 5 just in the last year. And he's also an alum.
Of the Stanford Graduate School of Education.
Yes. Welcome, Eric. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much. I'm honored to be here and proud to be an alum and grateful for all the work that you guys continue to do. And to be able to be a partner of Stanford and be leading a school just down the road is just a great treat for me.
It's exciting.
Oh my God, is this guy a superintendent? A politician
Be nice, Dan. So here, this is a super basic question,
yes.
But I know people have this on their mind.
Uh-huh.
A lot of people know what a principal does, and they see the principal day in and day out. Mm-hmm. What does a superintendent do all day long?
That's a great question. I would say the easy answer is that my job is to take the policy that the school board has adopted and bring it to life. What most people don't realize is that the school board has one employee, and that is the superintendent, and every other employee of the school district is an employee of the actual district under the leadership of the superintendent.
That's
and so
interesting.
When you have five bosses, or in some cases seven bosses, who are on some level politicians because they got elected to their job, and they each have different interests and passions and expert areas of expertise and so forth. It makes for a very interesting, sometimes very political job. My job also entails keeping students safe, the learning rigorous and aligned to the state expectations, and to ensure that we have the best and brightest educators and staff in front of the kids, and that they're paid as much as we can afford to pay them, and that they are working in an environment that's as positive and supportive and growth oriented as we can make it.
Piece of cake. Doesn't that sound like an easy job?
So the answer is everything.
Yes.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Dan.
Something you said, it never occurred to me, the school board can't reach through you to get rid of a principal.
Oh, no.
That you are responsible for that, and they can't tell you how to do that. They could fire you if they don't like what
exactly,
you do,
yeah.
But they can't tell you what to do.
Exactly. Yeah. And that, that is something I'm very fortunate, and Dan, sorry, this may sound like a political answer, but it's very true. I'm very fortunate to work for a very talented board that understands sort of what we call the governance line pretty well. Sometimes we have to be reminded, that might be below the line of governance and so forth. But a lot of superintendents struggle with the fact that board members don't know that line. And I often tell folks that there are three types of board members. The first type is somebody who is running for board and elected to board because they want future higher political office. And that's not a bad thing. It happens particularly in larger school districts, big city school districts or school districts that span a wide, vast area. Another type is what I'd call the advocacy board member, which is somebody who has one or two really important issues that they're very passionate about. Oftentimes, they weren't happy with how something went, and so they run particularly on that issue. And then when they serve as a board member, while they have broad issues that they have to cover, they're particularly interested in seeing that one come to pass. And then the last one is people who are just interested in good governance. They're not looking at what's next. They didn't necessarily come with one or two pet issues that they're very passionate about. They're just really interested in policy and good governance and in community engagement. And so I think most superintendents experience some combination of all three of those types of board members.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are talking today with Eric Burmeister, superintendent of schools in Menlo Park, California, about the job of a superintendent. And when you were talking about the different kind of board members, I was thinking, well, he forgot the wackadoodle board member.
If you're applying for a job as a faculty member, you give a talk, right? You give the talk.
Yes.
It means a lot.
It's
and
important.
Then everybody watches, and then, they make their judgments. So this one guy comes in, he gives a talk, and he's studying policy, but he's studying it more in an ethnographic approach towards policy, and he's looking at school boards. And he shows this videotape of this school board where they're just screaming at each other, and one guy gets up and grabs a chair and chases the other guy. And it was just like, oh my God. So how's your school board?
Well, our school board fortunately is great. And I have, when you are the superintendent of a relatively small school district like I am, the politics of it aren't attractive to people that are looking for a soapbox or for a stage on which to perform or share their wackadoodleness, so to speak. but I've heard it once said, said, and you guys may even know who said it, that democracy is the worst form of government except for all the other options. Mm-hmm.
That's a great line.
And you know, I find that to be very true in school board politics as well, is that, you know, it is imperfect, but at the same time, it really does reinforce the truly public benefit nature of why public schools were created in the first place. And it holds all of us accountable to the people who, at the end of the day, pay our bills, which is the taxpayer. And so it's interesting from the seat that I currently serve in as superintendent. It's you know, when you're a teacher or a principal or even a district office staff person, it's really hard to understand the nature of the beast until you've actually sat in that seat. But there are, you know, I've not had any of those examples of chair throwing or anything like that, but I have had divided boards and divided perspectives before, it's often said when you become a superintendent by other superintendents that your number one job and at least 50% of your time is spent on what they call the care and feeding of the board. Mm-hmm. And it's important because you don't want the political drama to supersede the good work and the consistent work that you've tried to create the foundation for over time. And so managing the politics of any situation is an important part of the superintendent's job.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are talking with Eric Burmeister about the life of a superintendent. And one thing that came up for me when you were talking is the concept of unions. Mm-hmm. And everybody hears about strikes. There's been a lot in the news. What is your role versus, should I not say versus, the union? And what is the role of the union? I think a lot of parents don't even really understand that.
Right. So, you know, it's interesting. So union folks see teachers as a profession, and they are. There's a lot of talk and attention paid to folks, teachers in particular, being treated as professionals. And yet they also have union rights. And they, for many, many years, have been a low-wage labor force. And a lot of people are unaware of both the history of how we got to the place that we are, but also sort of the dynamic of being a profession that we want to hold highly, as well as a labor force with whom we have to engage in labor negotiations, because it really is, unfortunately, a relatively historically low-wage labor force. And so trying to elevate the teaching profession while at the same time keeping costs within the realm of what your state and federal government are willing to provide is sort of the challenge of the superintendent. And so I see, you know, my job as really being about educating the community in particular on why having high quality, well-prepared, and incredibly supported teachers and retaining them is the single most important thing we can do as a community, because at the end of the day, as researchers, you know that there is nothing that research has found that can do more for closing the achievement gap or increasing student achievement than having a high quality, well-trained teacher. In fact, 3 years consistently and consecutively of high quality teacher in front of a student, that's really going to make the difference. So I see my job as educating the community that you cannot do education on the cheap, and whatever we can do and whenever we can do it to invest in our teachers is my number one job.
I know you come from a wealthy district. I feel for the districts that have to make the decisions that are really tough, where they can't do that, and mm-hmm. yet you've got the teacher who needs to put food on the table.
Absolutely.
And it's in other countries, the teachers are paid much more.
Yep. Yeah, it's a real challenge, and you know, in California is unique in the sense that districts like mine end up receiving more money than districts that serve a more low income community, and you know, we have to solve it. I have ideas of how we might do that, but I know that's not the topic of this show.
We'll have you back for that one. Maybe sometime we can talk about it.
But you know, it is a real challenge, and I think you know, this summer I actually was on a panel at the National Principals Conference with the state superintendent of education from Oklahoma, and they recently went through a whole round of strikes and negotiations, and a lot of states that are small like Oklahoma have a lot more influence at the state level in terms of how much teachers are paid. We fundamentally as a nation have got to come together and have a new conversation about the role of public education if we're going to be able to solve this problem, because I think we're talking over each other a lot, and we have to have a massive reinvestment in K-12 education if we are going to build the economy that we want to build over the next 100 years. But again, that's for another.
No, it's not. It's all relevant. Denise's polite. I'm not. So give me your best solution.
Well, in California, we got to do something about Prop 13. And I'm not saying that I have the right answer.
Can you say a little bit about what Prop 13
is? Sure. So Proposition 13 is the late 1970s tax reform proposition that dramatically changed how the state of California garnered property taxes, and thus how local services such as schools, fire districts, city governments, and so forth were funded.
The tax on your real estate can only go up by a small percentage year over year, which was a way for old people not to sort of get priced out of their neighborhoods as the value of houses went up.
Yeah.
And so the tax isn't tied to the value of the house, which of course means less tax revenue.
Right. And, you know, the challenge is that California went from really the envy of the nation in terms of public schools in a very short order, became one of the lowest performing and one of the lowest funded states in the nation. And it can all be traced back to that change. And again, I'm not saying that, you know, that the tax policy prior to Prop 13 was excellent. And I'm not saying what's resulted hasn't resulted in some good. I'm just saying that if we are going to make a dent in the issue of supporting, recruiting, and retaining high quality teachers, we've got to look at funding. And one good thing is that in 2020 there will be a proposition on the ballot. My understanding is that they are making some revisions to that, which I think are good revisions that are going to help increase the support for that. But I would encourage any listener to find out more about that and to become educated about the impacts of Prop 13 and how we can come together as a state to do tax policy 3.0.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We will have more with Eric Burmeister, the role of the superintendent, and tax policy 3.0 next on Sirius XM Insight 121.
Students focus on what they were told, not paying attention to the situation.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
So they're not going to see anything new because they're so busy trying to copy what you told them.
From the campus of Stanford University. Welcome back to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are talking with Superintendent Eric Burmeister, Superintendent of Schools in Menlo Park, California, about the role of the superintendent.
So we've been talking about unions, school boards, taxes.
Really fun things.
Yes, gripping.
Well, I think they demand a lot of a superintendent's attention.
Yes.
But let's talk about kids. So in many places, school is just about to restart. You have a lot of expertise, so what are the tips you've got? Like, have a really nice new lunchbox. What are the kinds of tips?
Well, I think we probably spend a lot more time on those things, like the new lunchbox, that aren't as important and impactful than the things that we probably should spend time on. So, you know, some of the things that I remind parents about is that each start of the school year is a great opportunity to to recalibrate. And one of the things that we talk about in education and sort of setting up learning is this idea of gradual release to responsibility. And one of the things that I see, and I think this is true in Silicon Valley, but I think it's true of just this generation of parents, which includes myself. I have an incoming kindergartner this year and incoming fourth grader this year.
Fun.
You know, I think that that in many ways we overparent because we think we have to and we think that's the right thing to do. And I just want to remind parents that our kids are extremely resilient, extremely capable, and they can't really express that resilience and capability if we don't give them the opportunity to do it. And so what I would encourage parents to do as they reset this year is think about some of those things that they can give up to their kid this year to really give them a confidence boost by trusting them and entrusting them with greater responsibility. I think it's a great way to start the year.
What's an example? So as a parent, I'll stop putting the video cam on the front of my kid's shirt.
Good start.
You know, I mean, I think it's what's important is developmental appropriateness. We want to make sure that we're giving kids the right amount of freedom and independence. But, you know, a lot of parents are making their lunches when their kids should be making their lunches. A lot of parents are picking out their kids' clothes when they should be picking out their kids' clothes. A lot of parents are getting their kids up when they should be getting up themselves. And I think depending on how old your kid is, and maybe it isn't even in reference to what's age appropriate, but what you did last year, right? And so for some kids who are really used to a lot of handholding, maybe just going cold turkey this beginning of this year is not the way to do it. But encourage parents to think about what did I do for my kids last year and what are some things that they can begin to do for themselves.
That's great.
And for any parent who has a child who's in middle school or high school, one of the most important things that I tell parents is get your kid advocating for themselves with the adults in their schools. Our parents, hopefully by and large, have completed seventh grade already. They need to let their seventh grader do seventh grade. And so being a former high school principal and middle school principal and teacher, I'm always reminding parents, you know, let go a little bit. It's time for your kid to stand on his or her own 2 feet, and they will fall down, and that's okay. You'll be there to pick them up, but you don't want to stop them from falling down.
I think that's great advice. I think parents are worried, well, if I'm not checking his homework every day, even if he's in seventh or eighth grade, he's going to fail.
Right.
Or, you know, if he's not being treated fairly in school and he's afraid to advocate for himself, I've got to do it. It's my mm-hmm. role as a mom.
Right.
It's hard.
It is hard, but that is life, right? We are going to be in situations as adults where fairness is not taken into consideration, and our kids have to be prepared with how to respond to that. And so I would say that's why I get in there as early as I can to those middle school parents and say, you should not be emailing the teacher. Your child can. They can CC you or you can see it, but your child really needs to be the one that's advocating for them and their needs. The other thing is the earlier you start this level of independence, the less you have to worry about the big consequences in high school. Those parents who are worried that their child's going to fail if they don't do this, my question for them is, what evidence do you have that that is true? Mm. So I think we have to trust our kids more, trust them earlier. The earlier we trust them, the better prepared they're going to be for high school.
I released responsibility too early. I would get a call from all of my son's teachers.
When he was like five. This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are speaking with Eric Burmeister. And I think it's time for a little game.
Fun.
Are you guys up for a game?
Fun.
Up for a game. Okay, this is the who you're going to call.
Who you going to call?
Like Ghostbusters.
Okay.
Do you get it?
Yes.
All right. Dan, you're going to go first, and then Eric will correct you. Okay. You are a parent. Who do you go to if you want to change your child's schedule? You are not happy with their schedule.
A Another more forceful parent.
Another more forceful parent. Eric, agree or disagree?
That would be a disagree.
Who should they go to if they want to change their child's schedule?
Well, if you're talking about elementary schools, and elementary schools, they don't really have schedules, so I'm going to put this in the context of a secondary student in middle or high school. In most places, the place that you'll want to go is to the student's school counselor. And oftentimes, schools will have papers that have requests that the student goes into the office, finds the paper, fills it out, and the student waits 24 to 48 hours. We need to build a little patience here because it's very busy there at the beginning of the year. And then within a day or two, the student will either usually be called down to talk about the change, we'll get a schedule delivered to their class with the change made, or we'll get called in to have a conversation about whether that change is the right decision or not. So I would say find out what your school's practice is, but generally speaking, it's the school counselor.
And it's not the superintendent.
And it's definitely not the superintendent.
Not okay.
And in most cases, it's also not the principal.
Okay. Now, you're a parent and you have a problem with your principal. Mm. Something went wrong and you do not like how your principal handled something. Mm-hmm. Dan, who are you going to call?
Ooh.
It's a toughie.
The principal's secretary or executive assistant.
Okay.
And explain what's going on and let the executive assistant handle the principal.
Eric, agree or disagree?
Well, embedded in Dan's response is a truth, which is that the person who really runs the school is the principal's secretary or principal's assistant. But I think the right answer is go to the principal. It's really important that the principal has an opportunity to both hear your concern and respond to it. And 95% of the time, the principal is going to be responsive and you guys are going to be able to find some common ground and get whatever the problem is solved. So first, you would go to the principal. And more than likely, if that parent is not satisfied, the principal is going to go to the assistant superintendent before the parent ever has to. But go to the principal first.
So you kind of answered my third question, which is, when would you ever, as a parent, mm-hmm. go to you, mm-hmm. the superintendent? We're going to skip Dan on this one.
Yes.
We're going right to you.
That's a great. So you know, in our district, we have a real commitment to customer service, and we believe that students are our primary customer, and parents and at the district office, our staff are a next very important customer, but don't take the lead over students. In the case of a parent who's really unhappy with a principal's decision or action, and they've gone to the principal and tried to work it out, the next place that they would go is they'd call the superintendent's office. They wouldn't get me, but they would get my assistant, and my assistant would direct them to the department lead of the issue at hand. So if it were education related, it would be our assistant superintendent. If it were special education or discipline related, student services. If it were finance related or facilities related, it would be the chief business officer. It would be a very rare occurrence where it would get to my level.
So all listeners take note. There are paths to go before you just write to your superintendent or march in the superintendent's office. Very informative. Eric, thank you so much for being here. We truly appreciate it. And
thank you
all of you for listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. If you missed any of this episode, listen anytime on demand with the SiriusXM app on iTunes and SoundCloud.
Of Stanford University, this has been Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.